This edition of Farming the Countryside is brought to you by ProFarmer. ProFarmer provides key information to help farmers make profitable decisions. Go to tryprofarmer.com for your free trial today. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. Buying, selling, trading, and the like are all a part of life and a part of business. How do you become a better negotiator and work to help both parties in the process? We'll take a look at some of the keys from an expert in the field as we discuss how we can apply ideas not only at the farm level, but in life and business of many kinds. It's our topic for this week's Farming the Countryside and is brought to you by ProFarmer. Start making confident marketing decisions with ProFarmer. ProFarmer's condensed style is designed to save you time while giving you the important information you need when making those important marketing decisions. And you'll stay on top of profit opportunities with ProFarmer's mobile sell alerts and easy-to-use mobile app. With spring planting just around the corner and a new crop ready to go in the ground, now's the perfect time to try a free trial. Get insights on marketing the grain you may still have in the bin and get ready for the season ahead. Plus, gain insights on the ever-volatile livestock markets. Start a ProFarmer free trial today. Visit tryprofarmer.com. That's tryprofarmer.com. The term negotiation can take on many meanings, and for many of us, it may bring thoughts of trying to get the best deal at perhaps the expense of others. Mark Faust at Echelon Management helps people do a better job at negotiating in business and in life, and he says that give and take doesn't necessarily need to have a winner and a loser. In fact, there are ways that both sides can win, and taking the time to invest in practices to help you better do that is key. We sat down to talk about some of the advice he shares with a number of clients and audiences on the topic. Mark, we have visited about a number of topics, but we're talking about negotiations, at least to begin with this time. Maybe I should start with this. Talk to me about what negotiations might mean in a farm setting. It can mean a lot of things to a lot of us. Yes. Sometimes it's just beating people up over price. I have a feeling we're going to go beyond that. But what should we be thinking about, maybe top level, about this thing about negotiations?
Well, a few of the tactics or points that I mentioned up front are things like never negotiate alone. With anything that's of note, a lot of money's on the table, involve other people on your team, whether it's your spouse or others, but prepare and also make it a process. The best negotiations have several touch points, and they aren't a tit-for-tat splitting of the difference, and that's another rule. Never split the difference. Yet how often have we done that as our ultimate negotiations tactic? Yeah, it's a time management tool, but it leaves a lot of money on the table. Set a negotiations goal with the other party. And that goal really should be about creating value together. That's the end goal.
Whenever we're thinking about these negotiations, give me an example, and it doesn't have to necessarily be specific, but what types of things might we be talking about when we're thinking about an ag operation, farming, and so forth? What kind of negotiations would I be using these techniques in?
Exactly. We think about the equipment and input purchases, and so often we look at it as one thing. That's another point here in negotiations. It's never one thing. The Harvard Negotiations Project started back in 1979. They've been researching negotiations ever since. What they've discovered, and one of the first big discoveries, that the ultimate tool is to create multiple equal offers. They call them MEOs. So even though you think it might be about that commodity or the lease or the purchase, whatever, there's more to it. There are the terms. There is the length of contract. You think of all the different facets of this relationship, whether it's a vendor, a landlord, or whatever, and start building out all those different facets of the relationship. And most of them are going to be negotiable. I've got one grower who's amazing at getting more acre. He gets 50% of all the people he meets with. That's his growth lever, is seeing the people. But as he goes out there, because he also has a tiling business, now he's able to get creative in what he's offering that landowner that nobody else can, that he's competing with. And not just the tiling, but also even how they care and prepare and make the land look and the edges, et cetera. They do some pretty amazing things and creative things. And there are options. Not every landowner wants that, but some are tickled to and are glad about the extra years in the contract and so forth. So in any event, multiple equal offers is the big idea. But how you get there, now that's what we got to talk about a little more in depth here.
So let's talk about that, because there is, I'm betting you're going to tell me, a lot I need to do before I ever perhaps negotiate or meet with this person or really begin to have substantive conversations. Would that be right?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, prepare. Preparation's key. But how do you do that? I've got a preparation sheet that we use for large, strategic negotiations. And let me just walk you through the three phases we go through to get to the MEOs, as we call them. You start with the consequences of no agreement. So think about that. Before you go into a negotiation, think about what will happen if there is no agreement. There are consequences on both sides. And it is critical in order to uncover where these new points of value that you're going to uncover to think about those consequences of no agreement. They call them CNAs. And so, again, this was something that was discovered in the negotiations research at Harvard, that when you brainstorm about the hard costs and the soft costs of you not being able to lock in your equipment purchase on the whole new system with, the big equipment dealer. The hard costs might be you're working with older equipment that's breaking down or isn't as productive. And there's a cost there. Write that down. There's soft costs, the frustration of having to go back and do this again with somebody else. Write down those soft costs. Now, there's also benefits. Well, the benefits is, you got capital in your back pocket that you wouldn't otherwise have. And list down all those benefits. Now, do the same thing for the other side. Now, after you've done that exercise and you look at that list, there's usually some epiphanies that happen at that point, and all of a sudden you start brainstorming and innovating ideas and options around terms or et cetera that you can use to create those multiple equal offers. But we're not done yet in preparation. The next step is to build out the seller's wish list or trades, as well as the buyer's wish lists and trades. You're going to rank that in order of priority, and you're going to put a percentage weight on each one of your points of issue, like the price. And you want to have a range. So let's say you're willing to pay $1 million to $1.2 million for this item, and you want to get it for the most visionary, you might think. And another thing to do with your goal on your side of the deal, not the goal of the mutual deal, which is creating more value and splitting the value. And your goal, let's say your top item, your major thing is the price. Well, maybe I would set an MVP, the minimum amount that you would be willing to accept, the visionary target that you're going for, and then the primary target. So your visionary target might be, $900,000 for this. Your primary target might be $1 million, but your minimum that you'd settle for is, I'll go as high as 1.2, but then after that, I'm walking away. But that's just one item. What about the terms? What about the interest rate? What about, service, et cetera, et cetera? And you build out all your wish lists. Now, you do the same thing on the other side. And you put down the range of what you think their range is and what you think their percentage weight and scale is on those things. Now, after looking at that, you're ready to do the main step in your preparation of the first negotiation discussion you're going to have of probably, several. And what you're building now is the questions list. You're going out to validate what you just created in your estimates of what you think is what they want and what you think you want, because your wants may change as well. And of course, it's needs first and then wants. But after you start to validate with these questions, you'll begin to be able to create value. I'm going to tell a story about a seed company to illustrate the point. I told the CFO and CEO Guys, we got to block off at least three sessions. You're going to negotiate with one of the world's largest companies and securing your contract on traits over the next so many years. There's a lot at stake here. Let's block off three 90-minute planning sessions minimally right now because this is coming up so quickly. And they thought that was a lot. They kind of pushed back on it. Well, you know, what's there to prepare about? Well, I took them through this process, and there were epiphanies all over the place. Long story short, when they were done with that negotiation, the company responded, "You got the best deal in the industry. You were the toughest negotiators. You were the smartest negotiators. You were also, in a way, one of the easier ones to work with because we enjoyed the process. But, damn, you guys got a good deal. We saved well into the seven figures beyond what we thought in regards to that total contract value. We made more money per hour preparing for negotiating that contract than they'll probably ever make in their life. But that's negotiations. Negotiations is the most valuable thing you do in an hour-by-hour investment. But where we drop the ball so often is not preparing.
So, Mark, when you talk about preparing, I know you talk a lot about thinking ahead to the questions you want to ask. How do you become a better question asker than, if you will, when you negotiate?
So here's how you build a great question. First, you write down the question you would love to ask, but you know you could never ask because they would just never answer it. How much max are you willing to pay? You know, that's the question we'd all love to ask and get the answer to. But there are ways you can soften that question, and here's the strategy to build a great question. Soften the question just a little bit. Tell me about, you know, the amount you might be willing to pay. Well, that's a slight, you know, refinement of the question. But after two or three iterations, it begins to evolve a little more. And by the third or fourth iteration of that question, you probably have come upon a much better question. I don't know if I can come up with one here so quick, but something like, so let's kind of talk about the investment. Let's talk about our goals. Have you guys been talking about this much? And I would segue into that question about, you know, do you have a mindset around some sort of number, just so we're not wasting each other's time? Give me a little, ballpark feedback on what you think we're talking about here. And then all of a sudden, you might start to get numerical data from the feedback you start hearing. And there's a great book I would suggest everybody read, Never Split the Difference. He went to the Harvard Negotiation Schools. And
it's a great school, book.
And he kicked some butt with those students, didn't he? Because he was a hardened FBI terrorist negotiator who saved lives for a living. And, he points out some of these rules probably more eloquently than anywhere else I've read about never negotiate alone, never split the difference, obviously, preparation, and the quality of your questions. He's also does a great job of establishing rapport.
Okay, then. So how do I better establish rapport in my negotiations?
I'm just going to simplify this and try to get this across in less than a minute. But when you walk into any meeting you have, whether it's an employee you got to fire or decide whether to hire or a big negotiations, intensely focus on that person across from you. Look deep into their eyes, sense what their emotional state of mind is, and adapt your communication style to them. The more you focus on somebody, the more you naturally do that. But when you're looking into their eyes and fully listening, you've already prepared. You don't need to worry about what am I going to say next. You're a lot more relaxed, and in that relaxed state, in focusing on them, in adjusting the pace of your speech to their pace, your volume to their volume, even the way you're sitting to the way they're sitting, proximics, you know, how close do you sit to? Some people need more space. Others kind of like to look in your face. Bottom line, you deepen rapport to a much higher level. Now, that's opening the door to more effective negotiations. That's an important facet. And with a deeper rapport, you can ask tough questions. Now, again, we've softened these questions through version 4.0 is where you want to get to minimally with all the tough questions. There are softeners like one of them is it seems like. So as you're listening, as you're gathering this information, using that segue of that phrase, what seems like you're saying, and then just getting quiet. You didn't even ask a question. They might start filling in the dead air there. And right there is a huge tactic. You know, great questions, having rapport, being relaxed and calm, and being silent and just letting the silence be filled with their information.
We focus some on high-level, big business types of negotiations, but I also know that you talk a lot about simply talking with our family members about family-run businesses and how we overcome some of the difficult challenges within those businesses. So I'd be interested in what you have to say about some of those types of things.
I had people come up after our session yesterday and talk about, oh, I've got one with my, you know, uncles and grandpa and dad and brothers, and you know, how about this negotiation? I said, guys, treat it like the negotiation that we just went through. Build out your CNAs. Build out the wish list and trades, and take your time. I mean, you could take a year to do this, and over lunch once a week, just slowly advance it, being patient. And odds are you can save the relationship, and you can and create new value.
Let's get into that business strategy for a moment then. What are some of the keys I need to keep in mind?
A lot of the best breakthroughs in negotiations come through breakthroughs in your business's strategy. Now, let's define strategy real simply. You know, there's classic definitions like, you know, strategy has to do with the decisions that determine the nature and direction of a business. Well, let me just boil it down to three words: vision, focus, and divergence. And what I mean by each of those is you have a vision for your business and the theory of its potential. And that theory of its potential, from where it is and where you think it might be able to go. So vision, focus. Every company, every business, every organization, profit, nonprofit, has one singular, what I call, primary source of leverage. And you can read about it in my book, High Growth Levers. But that PSL means that if you focus on innovating that area, you'll get a higher return than anywhere else. You might have a unique selling methodology. You might have a unique product. You might have a unique market or marketplace or customer type. But whatever it is, you have a primary source of leverage. As you identify that, there's areas in there that are going to lead to negotiations with some resource or customer or vendor. In fact, Michael Porter, the strategy guy of Harvard Business School, has an analysis where he goes through what he calls the five forces. And I think there's a couple others, so I call them the seven pressures in my book, High Growth Levers. But you want to innovate your relationships with employees, with your IP, your intellectual property, your vendors. But let's just look at vendors. So the tactic, as I mentioned, bring your vendors in and have innovation sessions. But think about how could we create defensible competitive advantage with our vendors that causes problems or you know, improves our effectiveness against competition. And it's those little areas of innovation in your strategy that ultimately usually lead to having some significant strategic negotiations with alliances that we all have in our businesses. Finally, divergence. You know, when you identify that point of focus and that primary source of leverage and other things in your business that are germane and high-level strategic issues, think about how to be totally different. How do you take a hard right turn or a hard left turn from the marketplace and others, from other vendor relationships or other employee relationships and cultures? And all of a sudden, start to truly become divergent and distinctive in creative and innovative ways, you're innovating the business.
One of the things I've heard you discuss when it comes to strategy is better defining my business. That you say we have to really think about what we do and how to best strategize to do that work.
You see these, multiple of businesses under an umbrella, and naturally you've started to synergize. You know, that's why you got into trucking, you know, because it's a synergy, and now you've got another business. Now run it like a business, but it has a different strategy. In fact, there was one ag retailer we worked with, and they tripled their nine-figure revenue in just a few years by mainly becoming more strategic. And what we figured out is we had seven businesses there. We didn't have one, but these were seven different units that deserved a separate P&L. And so we got a CFO to make that happen. And as we start to strategize and build the strategies of each of these, you know, there was the consulting business, which was service focused. And how do we take service, you know, and that was the primary source of leverage for the consulting business. And so how did we become world class, not distinctive, not just competitive, not just distinctive, but breakthrough in our service if that's going to be our strategy? So we had things like return all calls within 5 minutes. Well, most salespeople and consultants can't do that, but you can have rolling phone switches turned on your phone systems, and all of a sudden people are following up for every customer call you get within 5 minutes. What does that do to customer impression? Even though you're still going to follow up the same time, you know, you would have anyway. So we built breakthrough strategy innovations in each of the business. One of them was the trucking business. Now, that's a totally different primary source of leverage. That's what we call a capacity-driven type of business. And the main thing is filling up the capacity. And it sounds illogical, but sometimes you can make more money selling empty capacity at a loss than not. I'll give you an example of a printing company we saved, fifth-generation printing company, about to go out of business, $20 million, 100 employees, not, you know, breaking even, meaning they're going to be out of business in a few years. And we were able to, within 6 weeks, through an innovation process of just six guys from the three shifts, come up with $600,000 of innovations. But one of the biggest ones was when we realized there was no line on the five printing lines and the four binding lines that was full, more than 65% full. So we had a lot of empty capacity. And I said, right now, guys, we are a capacity-driven business. This has got to be our focus. We can empower our salespeople as a marketing expense to sell printing on stock that we have in stock that is going to go bad, and you know, we might as well give it away practically, but do it, you know, strategically. Let's go to non-customers who we haven't worked with in the last 2 years. Let's give them an irresistible offer on stuff that's going rotten in our empty space, and it's a one-shot deal, and they got, you know, so many hours to answer. And of course the CFO fought that like crazy. He says, you're going to turn our sales guys into price whores, et cetera. And in reality, we saved the company. We increased profitability by over $2 million. And that tactic was critical to getting them up to capacity. We were selling at a loss in those cases. But that investment, it increased profitability, but that investment also bought new customers and locked them in. Because they did have a quality in their production, and we shifted gears, and we changed the strategy. Strategy must be sentient. In other words, you've got to adjust. There was no strategy 30 days into COVID that was still valid, and there were people that didn't change their strategy for a year, but most of them went out of business. So the point is, you've got to be sentient with your strategy, and in this case, at the printing company, we shifted gears from a capacity-driven primary source of leverage to a market focused driven primary source of leverage. We focused on the medical text, the cookbook text, the ones that demanded the highest quality printing in the world and had much higher margins. And as we shifted gears to there, you know, things got very sexy with profits.
Where do we go wrong most often? If there's one thing that you could say, hey, you know, negotiations are so much, but just keep this in mind top level, what would it be?
That's a great question, and I would say, to just sum it up, you know, in negotiations, it's a little bit of our fear and trepidation. Number two, going in it alone. We heard from Lon Fromm yesterday how he doesn't do the negotiations. He has his 16 guys around the table kind of do it together, and they negotiate as a team, and they get killer deals, you know. And so never negotiating alone, and you know, being just, we go wrong by not preparing and not building the questions. When you build a questioning vocabulary, you are building one of the most profitable business tools you'll ever create. And that's kind of the crux of negotiations and what leads to those multiple equal offers and creating and splitting value, not the difference.
You can find Mark, his books, and much of his work in the area of negotiation and more at echelonmanagement.com. That's Echelon, spelled ECHELON, management.com. Thanks for joining me on this week's show. Remember, you can follow Farming the Countryside and our daily show, American Countryside, on Facebook, Twitter, or X, Instagram, and YouTube. Just type in Farming the Countryside or American Countryside. And you can hear these shows in a variety of ways as well at farmingthecountryside.com, on many local radio stations, or on your favorite podcast platform. If you miss one of our shows, just use those platforms to go back and catch other topics of interest as well. We try to have a variety of guests who provide information impacting many parts of the ag industry and rural America. I appreciate you joining me. I'm Andrew McCray. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. This edition of Farming the Countryside has been brought to you by ProFarmer. ProFarmer provides key information to help farmers make profitable decisions. Go to tryprofarmer.com for your free trial today.